Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Are we good? You there, Jeff? All right.
All right.
Let's roll. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here today with just Sarah Cliff.
Hey, Matt.
We are a little bit off schedule. Life is complicated.
Well, there's a bit of news. One of our Weeds co-hosts, so if you are an Ezra Klein Show listener, you may have heard that our Weeds co-host Ezra Klein is now a parent.
He is.
He had a baby last week. Everyone seems to be healthy and happy and getting into the swing of things. You can hear a little more from him on the Ezra Klein Show. And so he will not be here for the next month or so, but we'll be here.
Since this is a kind of cuddly, soft place of employment, we got people out on leave. We got people late to their appointments.
But we're super excited for Ezra.
We are.
Congratulations. We miss you, but we are very excited for you.
It's amazing. Someday, all the Weeds babies are going to have to record a podcast.
Yes.
They don't know it yet.
They don't know it.
But it's going to happen.
They'll have like 2024 takes.
It's going to be amazing. We'll do them for a live show. No.
Okay.
So that'll be good. Okay. So we're going to talk today about Amy Klobuchar.
Yes.
Senator from Minnesota. Interesting ideas about antitrust policy. We're not talking about that. They're putting that aside. Amy Klobuchar is an interesting politician. A lot of people get presidential buzz because, you know, they do something noteworthy or they represent an interesting, like, new demographic or a distinct ideological cause. And Klobuchar wasn't really like that. Instead, some people who'd been, like, working away at this after the 2016 election, like stats guys, like the Democratic Party sabermetricians, reached the conclusion that Amy Klobuchar overperforms the electoral fundamentals, like, more than any other statewide elected official. So people want to beat Donald Trump, and they're starting to be like Amy Klobuchar hype. And every time I would mention that to anybody I know who works on the Hill, they'd be like, well, you know what they say about Amy Klobuchar. And after enough of these conversations, like, I did know what they say about Amy Klobuchar.
What they say about Amy Klobuchar.
They said she's a bad boss. And it's a frustrating situation for a reporter because you would hear a lot of, like, mm-hmm. second or third hand stories, right? Just like random gossip, right? Which, like, it was shaping the coverage. It was clearly relevant to Democratic Party politics. But, like, I couldn't write an article saying, like, totally baseless rumors are flying around Capitol Hill saying Amy Klobuchar has done this or that. But, you know, people who are more diligent reporters than I am, like, ran these stories down and have started to produce, you know, real journalism with sources about
her treatment.
Right. So we've seen
this wave of stories in the past 2 or 3 weeks, starting with a story from the Huffington Post by Amanda Turkel and Molly Redden, followed by a story in BuzzFeed, followed by a story in the New York Times that have all these anecdotes about Amy Klobuchar, ranging from, a staffer who forgot to bring a fork with her salad on the airplane, leading to a stern reprimand, her eating the salad with a comb and tasking that staffer with cleaning the comb. There have also, and I'd say, like, there's a big range of things. So you have things like that. You have things like a remark that she made to her staffers when she was thirsty that she would trade the three of them for a bottle of water. you also have things like HR policies, where I think one of the most notable things I've read in any of these Amy Klobuchar stories was this expectation or office that if you took any sort of parental leave, that you would need to stay three times as long after you came back, kind of an unspoken, maybe spoken agreement that you couldn't just take off after taking your leave. And this has created a debate, you know, in media, in the politics world about, you know, why Amy Klobuchar is getting this coverage. Does this have to do with the fact that she is a woman? Is she legitimately a bad boss? Is she getting criticized in a way a male boss would? You know, you can read a piece our colleague here, Laura McGann, wrote, kind of arguing that a lot of this coverage has a sexist tone to it. You know, as I've read through it, it seems to me that both things can be true, that I think women are going to get more attention to their management style, you know, because it is more unusual to have, you know, a demanding, a boss who acts in the way that Amy Klobuchar does, who is female. At the same time, you know, some of the things in these articles I think are, like, legitimately troubling, particularly this stuff around the leave policy, you know, some of her interactions that have been reported. I think, you know, it can be both of these things happening at once, colliding into each other.
I keep feeling, as I have heard these rumors and then read these stories, like a troubling situation where, like, the factual details matter a lot to me in terms of how I'm thinking about this.
Sure.
And I'm not really clear on them, right? So, like, one thing that was reported in one of these stories and that also I had heard through the grapevine is that Amy Klobuchar threw a binder at somebody. But then maybe she didn't throw a binder at somebody. Maybe she just threw a binder in frustration and there was a person who was there. And there's a big difference between throwing a binder at someone but missing them and throwing a binder out of aimless frustration and it may be coming close to someone. Like, there is, you know, like, but you can even see how, like, two people actually witnessing the same event would disagree as to what had happened. And then also, in my mind, there is a huge difference between somebody once over the course of an 18-year career threw a binder in anger and somebody routinely throws objects in anger, right? Like, those are very, because, like, nobody deserves to be judged on the basis of their worst day. You know what I mean? Like, it's not okay to throw things at people, but, like, everyone has done something that is not great, you know? But if you're doing it all the time, that's, like, really, really much worse. And it is always, like, a thing that, like, I just think is challenging about journalism in general is that, like, what you want to know about these things is fact patterns, not just individual anecdotes. And it's really hard to tell. So people will write a story. It's like, this story is about how much people don't like working for Amy Klobuchar. And then the bulk of the stuff in the story will be things that you read it, if you read it with a skeptical eye, if you have read Kate Mann's book and you have listened to her appearance on the Ezra Klein show, you'll have, I think, the reaction Laura had and be like, I don't know, like, she sends harsh emails, like, she really wants people to be deferential to her. Like, why are we so upset about this? But then there will be a couple things sprinkled in the story that you're like, oh, no, like, that is really bad, right? And so then the question is like, are we looking at a background noise of misogyny plus two cherry-picked things out of over more than a decade of behavior? Or are we looking at a constant pattern of egregious behavior in which emails just happen to be easier to document?
And I think layered on top of this is what a weird place Congress is to work and, like, the weird situation that congressional staff end up in that are just not normal parts of the job. So, you know, something, you know, I have seen just living in D.C., I've heard from friends who worked on the Hill, is sometimes you get assigned some, like, weird tasks. And some of those you are not actually supposed to be assigned. Things like, you know, walking a congressperson's dog or watching the dog when it comes to the office or picking up dry cleaning, those sorts of things are the tasks that a low-level person in a congressperson's office might be tasked with doing. And, you know, on the one hand, like, it would be very weird if my boss asked me to walk her dog or to pick up her dry cleaning or, you know, to run to CVS to get her some nylons. Like, those would be very odd tasks. On the other hand, you know, when you're in Congress, a big part of your job is stepping in front of cameras. It is being presentable. You know, having nylons on hand, having a clean suit jacket, those are things you need to do your job. You're very time pressed. You are running from one meeting to another. So it becomes not super unusual for those tasks to kind of go to interns, to low-level folks. And it's a fuzzier line than I think you'd see in a lot of the workplaces that we're used to, where those things would be quite obviously not allowed. You know, my boss, you know, I would pick her up a salad. If I'm going out to get a salad, it'd be very weird for her to ask, like, a senior writer at Vox, like, go get that salad.
If we can actually completely sidebar for maybe the whole chart, like, I actually think this is, like, a big problem in America, right? Because, like, yes, like, our boss would not ask us to do stuff like that. At the same time, it would not be unusual if, like, the big boss of a huge company just, like, had a personal assistant whose job was, if not personally, to drop off dry cleaning, to, like, to make sure that all of that stuff is done. It's considered valid in a big workplace to be like, look, instead of having the CEO spending time out of his workday, like, fussing around with his dentist appointment, like, we are going to hire an assistant whose job is to take all this stuff off his plate, right? And in Congress, a lot of members of Congress are very wealthy, right? And members of Congress who are independently wealthy, like, deploy their wealth to strategically enhance their work as members of Congress. So, for example, one thing that they will do is, in addition to owning a house where they live in their district, they will own a second house in Washington, D.C. It'll often be a big house. And at that big house, they can entertain people, which is, like, it's politics. You know what I mean? Like, sure, like, having a party is, like, a social event, but, like, it's also a political move. And they can pay people out of pocket to be household staff so that they always have their dry cleaning done and blah, 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 blah. Then you have other members who are trying to live on the congressional salary, which, to be clear, it's not like it's a poverty wage or anything.
Right. I think it's about $160,000 right now.
But that is not enough money to maintain two different households, you know? So you have House members sleeping in their offices. You have people, like, bunking up, like, roommates, like 20-somethings. And, you know, again, it's not like they're living under terrible living conditions, right? But they are not living like important high-status people. But the resource that they have at their disposal is not money, but staffers. So you can make up for some of these ragged edges by having the staff do this kind of thing. But it's technically against the rules, you know, and you're putting people in a weird position. And I think that, like, separately from the questions about, like, how you should manage your staff, like, we should treat members of Congress a lot better, in my view. Like, we should pay them more. We should give them bigger staff. We should let them have personal assistants or, like, DC butlers or something like that. Because, like, you know, like, it's weird to have legislative aide told they've got to go wash dishes at the senator's house. But also, like, senators are busy people. It's completely reasonable that they would outsource, like, house cleaning tasks to somebody else.
Yeah, I think that's actually an unpopular view probably both of us share, is that I think most people who work in Congress, both members of Congress and senators and their staff, should actually be paid significantly more. You've actually seen their pay stagnate over the past decade or so. And I think, like you're saying, it creates these situations where, you know, you have folks who are using their staff in kind of inappropriate personal ways. It also makes it a lot more attractive for good people to leave, go lobby where they can earn a bigger salary. Like, the whole system, it really is not set up for someone to have, like, a lengthy career in Congress. So you see kind of a bit of a bottleneck where you have a lot of lower-level staff who are doing these kind of tasks, who are starting to learn how to write policy. And then, you know, pharma comes along and they can pay you a lot more money than Congress. Congress is capped in how much it can pay you, that they can't raise your salary even though you're doing a great job. I think there would be such huge – and then you end up with industry kind of writing – this is getting a little far afield from the Klobuchar situation, but you end up with industry writing a lot of policy because they've hired all these people – they're showing up with a lot of the expertise that the folks in Congress no longer have. You know, not to say there are a lot of diligent congressional staffers who I've worked with who are quite smart on policy issues, but they are making the conscious decision to trade a much larger salary and trade a, you know, work lifestyle where you're probably not going to be asked to do the type of tasks you'd be asked to do in Congress. So it really is a difficult system that we've set up. And I do get, like, you know, it is not a winning issue for members of Congress to campaign to, like, raise their salaries, to raise their staff salaries. But it ends up with a lot of weird limiting situations that I don't think are great for how policy gets made in Congress.
But let's take a break, because then we should rush back to Amy Klobuchar.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I think, like, life for congressional staffers is not that great for some of the reasons that we've talked about. And, like, there should be things done systematically to improve it. At the same time, the specific complaint about Klobuchar is not that life as a Klobuchar staffer is bad because the life of congressional staffers in general is bad, but is that she is, in fact, an unusually difficult person to work for. And to the best of my knowledge, like, that is true. Like, there is some – I was saying before that, like, the facts matter to me, and it's not 100% clear to me, like, what is true. But, like, that her office is a below-average quality of life place to work seems to be real. And then at the same time, I do think it is true that the extent to which this looms large – in her image and has been such a focus of campaign stories reflects a mentality of misogyny, that there is a expectation that a woman will be a nurturer and a carer, and that there is maybe an ideal that all people will be nurturers and carers. But to learn that a man is not a nurturing and caring person, but he may have other qualities that offset it, is something that we are very comfortable with. You know, like, he's doing other stuff. You know, that's fine. Whereas it is seen as a woman's responsibility to be a sort of metaphorical teacher or mother or caring type figure to everybody who is in her vicinity, and that to be selfish you know, and to be unsparing, to just be mad about the salad screw up and not care about your subordinate's feelings is seen as a bigger violation, right? That it's not that we don't hold everyone to the theory that, like, it's good to be nice, but it's, I do think, like, the reason it is such a big deal that Amy Klobuchar seems to be not such a nice boss, just like the reason it was such a big deal that Hillary Clinton was a sort of political opportunist, is that, like, it's not seen as okay for women to behave in these kinds of violating ways.
Well, I think in it, you know, especially for a legislator like Klobuchar, who kind of has this, like, Midwestern nice vibe going on,
yeah,
like, that I think that's kind of when we go back to, like, where we started our conversation. One of the things that these sabermetricians kind of saw in her and liked about her, she seemed like this, you know, warm, nice, appealing person. And I think that, you know, plays to a very gendered view of who women are and how they interact with people. And then this feels like it is in stark contrast with that image. I think that might be one reason why this gets, you know, more attention than it might be for, you know, a male boss, for a male legislator, for even another female legislator. I don't know if this would get as much attention because of that contrast. And I think, you know, I feel pretty torn about all this stuff because I think, you know, on the one hand, women are just going to get more attention to their leadership style. And I think, like, women who went, or anyone who went into Klobuchar's office, might have had a different expectation of what it was like to work there. And I think you might just have less staffers coming forward in a man's office because, you know, they might have thought, you know, this is just how men get angry. You know, he's an important senator. Sometimes he throws a binder, like, whatever. That's just what comes with the territory of working for a high-profile senator's office. You might not see them coming forward and those rumors circulating because it's kind of assumed just to be the status quo. That doesn't make it okay. That doesn't make it a good way to manage people. Like, everything I've read about Klobuchar's office doesn't suggest it's a type of place I would work. And, you know, the things that trouble me a little bit more than, like, the salad fork incident or, you know, some of the remarks, which it's really hard to tell, you know, just like the binder, there's this, we can't tell if it's like a joke or it really was very mean. This remark she made to three of her staffers one day when she was very thirsty, saying she would trade them for a bottle of water.
Sure.
That feels like the verbal version of the binder. Like, was it just thrown on the ground? Like, was this actually a very mean thing to say? Like, the context feels very important. The things that, like, have worried me, the things I'm more concerned about are the things that are less flashy, like this idea that there was pressure to stay if you were someone who's going to take parental leave. That would be a really troubling thing about a workplace. There was some reporting, I believe in the New York Times, about her making it difficult for people to move on to other jobs. Like, that seems like a not great management tactic. Those bigger HR management things, those feel a little more troubling to me than, like, these scattered anecdotes I've read where it's really hard to tell out of context, like, what was actually going on there.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I would say about this, right, like, I've been this whole time trying to, like, maintain two thoughts in my head, right? Like, one is that I feel like there is a gender double standard about this kind of thing. Like, how bad is it? How damning is it to, like, be a shitty boss? But then the other thought I have is that, like, I don't think in this case it makes sense to, like, level down, right? That, like, if anything, we have been too easy on, right? Like, in a different conversation that had a different framing, we would be talking about a male politician who has been a bad boss and who has been skating for a long time on this, right? And I think, like, the feminist take on this would be that, like, toxic masculinity is hurting people, right? That, like, this tendency to be forgiving of, like, men's rage outbursts and, like, total uncaringness about people below them in hierarchies is bad, and that, like, we should hold men to closer to the expectations we have of women in leadership roles, that, like, they should be kind and respectful to people and caring about them as human beings and not just treat them as, like, disposable means. And, you know, this is something that I think about a lot as a parent of a little boy, right? That I think there's a there's like a very solid, you know, consensus in sort of forward thinking, you know, urbane educated circles about girls, right? And like how, you know, they all have their future as female t-shirts and, you know, you like encourage them, like, be more assertive, be more, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I think the harder thing is like with boys, right? It's like, do we teach them to be less assertive, right? Like, right. do we take some of the expectations that are put on girls and like try to put them on little boys? And I think that to an extent, like, we have to, right? That like, there are real virtues to these things. Like, it is unfair to single-handedly, you know, hold women to standards of like kindness and emotional support and things like that. But it's also like the appropriate remedy is not to like purge society of that kind of caring and emotional labor. Like, it's actually really important.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It reminds me of something, you know, when I was researching the episode I did for Netflix about the gender wage gap, because I think it ties to a lot of that. One of the things Hillary Clinton wrote in her book, It Takes a Village, is that, you know, we're only going to get to a place of gender equity, you know, not just when we accept women as breadwinners, but we also accept men as caregivers. And I think that transition has been like a lot harder to make. I think you see this a lot, like in how it plays out in parental leave policy, where you see men being offered leave, but not taking nearly as much as women. I was doing a bit of research around California has a paid leave policy that they've had for quite some time that I was looking at for some work I'm doing. And one of the things that I thought was really notable is that, so this paid leave policy is on its face gender neutral, but one of the things you've seen is it's resulted in women taking 5 more weeks of leave and men taking 2 more days of leave. Like, it is being used in a very gender inequitable way. And I think when you kind of grow up in a society, like I look at my son's daycare, and I think most daycares across the country are staffed primarily by women. You know, he is growing up in a world where like he is a great dad who's super involved, who is a great caregiver. But, you know, for the most part, like all the caregiving he's going to see in his first years of life are going to be from women. And I think that's going to shape how he sees things, you know, regardless of everything we tell him about being like a good, empathetic person. And I think that just shapes, you know, up, you know, through adulthood, how we view what role people are having. So, and I think it really goes, and then it goes to like what stories are reported, right? Like, who's going to come forward to a reporter and say, you know, this boss is terrible to work for because like they are not adhering to what I expect a boss to act like. So, you know, it seems entirely possible that there are certainly equally bad bosses elsewhere in Congress who, you know, the rumors might not be flying around as much. I don't think the rumors are being ignored, but the rumors might not be flying around much because it's just not seen as abnormal when it's coming from a male boss.
But now, here's where my takes get really hot. Okay. I think that some of the discourse on the left has gotten a little off the rails around gender bias and female presidential candidates in the wake of Hillary Clinton losing. And to make my point, I think it's helpful to like turn the time machine back to 2007, 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president, right? I think every single person on the broad tent left in American politics agreed that like there is some racial bias in American politics, and that this was a potential problem for black politicians. Nobody thought that like the appropriate remedy to that was to run somebody who would alarm white America and lose the election and then do hot takes about how it was bad, right? Like, there was a real there's a thing it's called the Jackie Robinson effect, right? And it goes back to the fact that Jackie Robinson, the first African-American Major League Baseball player, was way better than the average baseball player. And then for years after he broke the color line, the average black player was significantly better than the average white player, right? And like that was a sign of discrimination because, you know, they were being held to a higher standard. And I think you clearly saw that in politics, right? Like, Barack Obama was not just an adequate, like, U.S. senator and orator. He was, like, way above average, right? And that's why, because it was so rare for African-American politicians to represent majority white constituencies. And if you talk to his team all throughout his presidency, right, like they were very cognizant that like they did not want him to show anger in the way that certain other politicians could, right? It was very important that he be a calm, cerebral figure. And I think at times this wound up like not serving the country all that well, like in the depths of the financial crisis, that like people sort of wanted somebody to be angry, but they didn't necessarily want like an angry black man to be angry. So we were in a bit of a double bind. But all things considered, very successful politician, won election twice, got a lot of stuff done, ended his term in office, very, very popular. And like, yes, like he had some unfair burdens on him, but also he won. He blazed some trails. There's been more opportunities for black politicians in his wake. And it may just be that a pioneering woman in presidential politics needs to like deal with the unfairness as a problem and not just kind of suffer. And then like we do articles about how that's not fair.
Well, and you see some version of this. There's actually some political scientists, Sarah Anzia and Chris Berry at Stanford and New Chicago. They wrote a paper in 2010 where they term something the Jill Robinson effect. So it's actually quite related to this, mm-hmm. of women in politics, where one of the things, you know, they had seen for a little while is that female politicians, the women who get elected to Congress, just tend to be better at being congresspeople than their male counterparts. They, you know, the metric that they use is their success in delivering federal spending to their districts. And they find that congresswomen secure roughly 9% more spending from federal discretionary programs than congressmen. This amounts to a premium of $49 million per year for being represented by a woman. And they argue it's essentially the same sort of thing going on, that if you're going to be a woman elected to political office in the United States, you're often blazing some kind of trail. You're dealing with some kind of gender discrimination that once you get there, you're going to have to outperform in order to kind of keep your job. You know, I think it's even more so than baseball. Like, people are literally voting on whether you get to keep your job every 2 years when you're in Congress. So you do see something quite similar already playing out for someone like Amy Klobuchar, for, you know, any woman who's being elected to Congress. It seems like they're going to have to prove they're better than the average guy who wants to run for Congress. And it sucks. Like, that's not great. It's also where we are right now. It's like a frustrating position to be in, you know, to acknowledge that it exists, you know, and I don't know fully how we grapple with it aside from, you know, continuously running more women and having more women in leadership till, you know, you slowly erode away at it over time. You know,
because I remember, yeah. you worried about this a couple of years ago, right? It's like when women get elected to statewide office, yes. then more women.
Yes. More women run, perceptions of women change. Like, you do see this snowball effect, but it's slow, right? Like we're working against like decades of gender norms and things changing. You know, it's not this like fast change. You know, I think we saw with President Obama serving in office, it's not like, you know, racism disappeared after that happened.
No. But I mean, there are more African Americans in statewide office than there were before Obama, right? And then you have others, right? I mean, you had like Stacey Abrams, Andrew Gillum, like they lost in the end, but like they got like fair shots at winnable races. And that hadn't really been happening that much before him. Anyway, I mean, it's all just to say that, like, actually winning is the most efficacious solution that people seem to have mm-hmm. to this issue, right? That at least, like, from what we can infer from the results of electing women to lower statewide offices, electing a woman president would create more opportunities for women politicians.
Yeah, everything we know from the political science research suggests, like, if that's what you want, if your goal is electing women, like, you start with electing women and you just, like, keep trying to run that cycle. And, I mean, we are in a situation, we have more women serving in Congress than ever before. You know, we're not anywhere near gender parity. We're pretty far behind a lot of legislatures elsewhere in the world, but we are at a high for the United States. So you do see, it's just, you know, it's just a frustratingly slow task of trying to, you know, get to a place where people would be equally likely to complain about a bad male boss and a bad female boss.
And in presidential politics, though, I mean, we've had, I'm trying to think, like, how many women presidential candidates in major parties have we had, right? So there's Hillary Clinton, Carol Moseley Braun, Shirley Chisholm on the Democratic side, more or less, right? Among Republicans, Carly Fiorina and Elizabeth Dole, I remember, right? So that's like five people of whom we can debate how many of them were like really, really serious contenders. I think arguably only Hillary has ever had like a moment in time when like it really seemed like, okay, that person might become president. You know, like out of that whole list. Whereas now, you know, you have between Klobuchar, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, that's four different people who, like, there's a big field. They're sort of all underdogs. But, like, nobody would be shocked if a visitor from 2 years in the future told me one of those four people became president, right? It wouldn't be like, how did that happen, right? You know, and then there's like Tulsi Gabbard, some other fringier people in the race. But like that is a huge increase. You know, like the historical baseline is really, really, really low. And I mean, I don't know like exactly what follows from this, but just that like in a weird way, I think it's possible to understate the value of like doing the work and winning.
Yes. I think winning, pro winning.
as far as we know. And you know, I don't know where that leaves us. And like it's not fair to like be told you have to be more perfect than perfect. But I don't know. Like it maybe just is what it is. And then, you know, the problem for Klobuchar also is that there isn't a ton behind her candidacy other than the theory that she'd be super popular, right? In a way that, like, Elizabeth, we've had, like, a million Weeds episodes about different Elizabeth Warren things. So to the extent that, like, if you heard something that reflected poorly on her, it would be perfectly coherent to be, like, putting that aside, there's, like, this whole other thing. Right. Whereas you are very vulnerable when you run a campaign that is a little like low on substance to being derailed by sort of, you know, stuff that you might otherwise say, who cares?
Right. I mean, like an interesting contrast is Senator Sanders, who has also dealt with a number of stories about the way his campaign runs, about the way staff are treated, but has a very clear policy vision that a lot of people care about with, you know, his Medicare for All platform, his other platforms, where someone, you know, we've had multiple episodes about the various policies that he's proposing. So you could see the calculation of, like, I don't really like that. And again, like, I totally admit, like, a lot of this is wrapped up in gender, too. Like, I think a man generally was more likely to be let off the hook for this kind of behavior. So putting that caveat in there, you could see a voter saying, you know, I don't like the way he treats his staff, but I really want a universal healthcare system. It's harder for me to, you know, see the person who says, I don't like how she treats her staff, but, like, I'm real jazzed up about antitrust, and, like, that is my issue. And I know it's not a perfect comparison, again, because, like, gender is playing into this in a lot of ways that I think are important. But I think you're right. Like, when we look at all these candidates, she's by far the least policy-heavy. I will say she's also the newest, right? Like, we're seeing policies roll out week by week. Like Elizabeth Warren just put out her pre-K-1 last week. I would expect that as Klobuchar settles into her run, we're going to see more policy documents from her. But I think she is more of a policy unknown to me going into the primary than the other folks who have, you know, thrown their hats in the ring so far.
Right. And then I think this also matters in terms of like opposition, right? Like I think it is unquestionably true that Sanders gets let off the hook by some people for some stuff that they would find objectionable from other people. But the flip side of that is that people who don't like Bernie Sanders, of whom there are also many, they dislike him for ideological reasons. You know, and they might like throw other stuff at him to try to take him down, but like fundamentally, they don't want a self-proclaimed socialist who won't join the Democratic Party to take over. You know, so it's like you polarize into – if you run a strongly ideological candidacy, right, you polarize along ideological grounds. If you don't, you polarize along personality grounds, right? And I think like the fair comparison to Klobuchar of people who are Buzz, male side, is not Bernie but probably Beto O'Rourke, right, who's like a similarly sort of hazy in terms of his issue profile, right? But who people, I mean, people like him because he's likable, essentially, right? And
it's a good live journal, too.
Yeah. Well, and I think it is fair to ask, right? Like, could a woman become a political superstar based purely on this kind of hazy charisma? Could a woman politician get away with this kind of like meandering road trip, right? Or like that kind of stuff. And I'm skeptical.
No.
You know, that like that to me seems more like it doesn't cut the like intra-party argument nearly as closely, right? Because it's like I see a lot of like Klobuchar-Bernie comparisons because they pull apart ideologically. But it's actually Beto who is similar to Klobuchar but a man and who I think doesn't have the same knocks against him, but like it's weird. He's this weird stuff going on there that I could not imagine a woman who like lost a race and then like flipped out, abandoned her school-age children to go drive around Kansas and talk to people in bars.
And write a very meandering Medium blog about it.
Yeah,
all the
explore
while.
Her feelings. Like I really don't think that would fly.
Yeah. Well, no, we've made it to gender equity when a woman can get popular doing that. All right. We actually have a really interesting, different white paper.
The greatest one of all
no
time.
No white paper we've ever done before.
Take a break.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, WISE.com. Wise.com.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prof G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Okay, so today we're doing something a little bit different. We are talking about a white paper that, as far as we can tell, does not exist.
It's fake.
So this was a really interesting thing that came up a few weeks ago that I've been wanting to talk about. One of our reporters, Kelsey Piper, she was reading this article in the New York Times Magazine where she noticed this statistic that jumped out at her. And I'll just read the sentence from the article where the writer Clive Thompson writes, in a 2016 experiment conducted with a tech recruiting firm, Speak with a Geek, 5,000 resumes with identical information were submitted to firms. When identifying details were removed from the resumes, 54% of the women received interview offers. When gendered names and other biographical information were given, only 5% of them did. Now, Kelsey's a reporter now, but she actually has a history as a recruiter. She worked as a recruiter before joining us. And she saw this and was like, that does not pass the smell test. The difference is so, so large. And, you know, what she had seen in her own work, it just did not align with it. So she starts to dig into this. And she finds somewhat incredibly that the study just doesn't seem to exist. The New York Times article cites an article from CNET, which cites a study done by a tech recruiting firm called Speak with a Geek that has since closed. She reaches out to the author, who says he's never actually seen the study. He was citing the CNET article. And he starts digging in. Clive starts looking for the study. He can't find it and actually takes the sentence out of his story in the Times, the online version, and issues a correction. And I think it was a really, you should read, Kelsey wrote a long piece about this, about kind of how this spread, about the reasons she was skeptical given her background, and how this really, you know, how an article no one has ever seen can suddenly show up in the New York Times. I thought it was a really fascinating look at how, you know, we talk about a lot of papers that definitely exist and they get cited in our stories, they get cited elsewhere, but how a paper that does not seem to exist, that no reporter, as far as we know of, has ever seen, has now ended up cited in multiple news articles.
I mean, it's a strange story. I mean, it's also a story about, it's always interesting showing you sort of implicitly, like, what people would like to be true. It would be sort of both, like, great to have, like, totally unambiguous, like, audit study results showing that the reason women are underrepresented in big tech companies is that there's just, like, blatant, crazy levels of overt discrimination in hiring. Both because, like, that would be a great article to write up, and also because it suggests some, like, relatively easy fixes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That, like, if you could just you know, there was like a story. I think there was some pretty good evidence of that kind of discrimination against musicians and orchestra performances. So there was like a move to go to a certain kind of blind audition thing. And it's both like a good story and also like actually an encouraging one, because there was like a pretty simple sort of structural fix. Whereas if you're going to say something more plausible about, like, you know, differential levels of interest in the subject that, like, may have partially genetic roots that propagate throughout years of, like, an education system and learning and, like, like, big social things that are, like, probably beyond the power of an individual hiring manager to alter, but are also the responsibility of leaders in the field to do something about, like, it's sort of a bummer, you know? Like, I think a realistic take on, like, gender issues in computer science does not suggest that you, the well-meaning HR vice president, can, like, just be like, we're going to fix it now.
Right. And I think one thing Kelsey writes about is actually there is some evidence that degendering applications can make things worse, because one of the things that's true right now is you just have a lot more men majoring in computer science. Only about 18% of computer science majors are women. So if you're going to go specifically on, like, the credentials someone's bringing to a job, you're just more likely to get a lot of men. If your goal is to bring women into more tech-based fields, one of the things she writes about is that this gender blinding situation is just missing the point, that you're going to get the people who have historically been advantaged in the industry before. They're going to do better in a blind situation. And I think you're right. It's like a situation where you want to do the right thing. It feels like, oh, okay, like, we can solve it. Like, and it is, like, I mean, like, looking back, if this was true, like, wouldn't you have expected, like, if it could have that big of an effect, you'd kind of expect this to take hold, that we'd be making more strides. I think one of the other things Kelsey points out about the orchestra situation is it is true, it really did reduce a lot of disparities, but it took years. It wasn't like they just ran an experiment and then, like, all of a sudden orchestras were gender equal. It's something that, like, slowly over time changed over. And I think it is, like, a disappointing study to read in terms of, like, how you think about we as reporters who deal with numbers, like, do our journalism. I think there can be a temptation to, you know, see a number in another story, link to that story, when really the thing you should be doing is going to read the actual study. There are all these barriers. And I will say there are all these barriers that make that the much easier thing to do. Like, one of the things I confront a lot is journalists don't get subscriptions to academic journals. So usually if I want to read an academic study, I have to message an intern at Vox who has a log into their college library. I have to message the researcher to see if they'll send me a copy. Most academic journals are behind some pretty expensive paywalls, so Vox does not subscribe to them. No publication I've worked at really subscribes to academic journals. I have, you know, complimentary press logins to a few big healthcare ones like JAMA and Health Affairs. But all the incentives, I think, are wrong here. The incentives lead you to do what this writer did and just cite another article and assume that they read the story. It would be great if academic research were a lot more accessible so that the incentives, it was a lot easier to do the right thing and like actually read the study.
Yes. But I mean, I do think when I see the popularity of something like this go around, right? Like, what always reminds me is that I think like the broad middle ground in America is uncomfortable with big demographic disparities when they reveal themselves, right? Like, it seems bad to see women so underrepresented in certain kinds of fields. People are also very uncomfortable with like hard affirmative action and quota type policies, you know, like deeply, deeply uncomfortable with that idea. So there is like a profound desire to believe in these kind of like one weird trick type scenarios that like you want to say, okay, we are going to remediate the disparity, but we are not going to lower the bar for anybody. We are not going to do quotas. And I just like, I think that it is unrealistic, you know? So like a really interesting study that I wrote about, a very real study done by Raj Chetty and his Equality of Opportunity team, it looked at inventors, right? It was rich data.
We talked about this on the show.
Yeah. And like basically what it's showing is that like to improve the pipeline of future female inventors, you need to raise the profile of the existing stock of women inventors, right? Because the role modeling effect is evidently quite real, right? So this means like doing things that people are going to be a little bit uncomfortable with, right? Like nobody wants to say, well, we're hyping this woman up a little bit more than her scientific contributions technically merit because women are underrepresented in this field and we need them to get more attention. But like actually it's a good idea, right? Because what alarms people about that is like the idea of that kind of like affirmative action for creating science celebrities, you worry that it's going to be like a slippery slope to like next thing you know, like all these totally inept like girl inventors are going to be running around. But like what the research shows is that like no, that it's like actually skilled people mm-hmm. are being driven out of the field by a lack of role models who they identify with, right? And but you need to do something to like create those role models. Like you have to like take hard steps, you know, and that can mean like checking your own biases. But like to be maximally effective, it needs to mean like going beyond checking your own biases, right? To just like actually saying like it is true that like most of the inventors out there are men. Like most of the famous inventions that have been done were made by men. And that fact is dissuading girls from becoming inventors. So you need to like have your kids' books like have more women scientists in them than is reflective of reality to like encourage. You're trying to like create the reality that you want, right? And that's just not as congenial, right, as like the belief that like, well, if we like gender blinded the resumes, we could fix the problem in 10 minutes.
Right. I mean, gender blinding's an easier solution. That would be nice to think that it had such a significant effect. And turns out that the numbers just aren't there. But I think I was very impressed with how the writer reacted to this, I will say, that he took the criticism very seriously. He ended up taking it out of his story. I think there can often be a instinct to kind of like hunker down and defend your work. And he was very magnanimous about it. And
the whole thing was great.
Credit for that.
In terms of like like the internet being a toxic cesspool, this was like really inspiring.
Yes.
Like Kelsey wrote like a thorough and like very persuasive debunking
of
this.
And very friendly debunking.
Yes. And he had like a honest and responsible reaction to it. And everybody all around was like, job well done, guys.
Right.
And
we kind of it was like a nice 30-minute episode. We all learned something at the end.
You know, and there's a real, to tie it all up, you know, like... displaying some kindness and concern in presentation of the criticism rather than being an asshole about it, I think led to a better result for everybody, and that we should encourage everybody to be more empathetic in their behavior.
Yes.
And with that,
come
empathetically into the Weeds Facebook group.
And criticize us, but empathetically.
No, nurture your fellow commenters. Encourage us all to do better in the future. Thanks for listening. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Jeffrey Geld, and the Weeds will return on Friday.